Okay, you're tuned to WORT 89.9 FM. Coming up next, Fiction Jones.
Now listen to my voice. My voice will help you and guide you still deeper into Europa. Every time you hear my voice, with every word and every number, you will enter a still deeper layer, open, relaxed, and receptive. I shall now count from 1 to 10. On the count of 10, you will be in Europa. I say 1. And as you focus your attention entirely on my voice, you will slowly begin to relax. 2. Your hands and your fingers are getting warmer and heavier. 3. The warmth is spreading through your arms, to your shoulders and your neck. 4. Your feet and your legs get heavier. 5. The warmth is spreading to the whole of your body. On 6, I want you to go deeper. I say 6. And the whole of your relaxed body is slowly beginning to sink. 7. You go deeper and deeper and deeper. Eight. On every breath you take, you go deeper. Nine. You are floating. On the mental count of 10, you will be in Europa. Be there at 10. I say 10. You are listening to the noise of rain beating against a large metal drum. Go closer. There's a fence, and you have to stop. You are walking across the rail yard, and you've been traveling by train from Bremerhaven, and before that, on a ship from New York. You are in Germany. The year is 1945.
That train from New York.
For Fiction Jones. This is WRT's Book Reading Hour. Tonight, part two of David Lindsay's 1920 visionary fantasy, A Voyage to Arcturus. In part one, we were introduced to a seance and a psychic display where a strange figure is materialized in an English drawing room for the amusement of the guests. Two unexpected visitors arrive. One of them, Maskell, is singularly disturbed by the materialization. He's invited to witness more psychic phenomena into Scottish observatory and promised an adventure on another world. Part two of A Voyage to Arcturus. "Listen, Craig," he said slowly, while peculiar images and conceptions started to travel in rich disorder through his mind. "You talk about this journey. Well, if that journey were possible, and I were given the chance of making it, I'd be willing never to come back. For 24 hours on that Arcturian planet of yours, I'd give my life. This is my attitude towards that journey. Now prove to me that you're not talking nonsense. Produce your credentials." Craig stared at him all the time he was speaking, his face gradually resuming its jesting expression. "Oh, you will get your 24 hours. Perhaps longer, but not much longer. You're an audacious fellow, Maskell, but this trip will prove a little strenuous for you, even for you. So like the unbelievers of old, you want a sign from heaven, do you?" Maskell frowned. "The whole thing is ridiculous. Our brains are overexcited by what took place back there. Let's go home and sleep it off." Craig detained him with one hand while groping in his breast pocket with the other. He presently fished out what resembled a small folding lens. The diameter of the glass did not exceed 2 inches. "First, take a peep of Arcturus through this, Maskell. It may serve as a precisional sign. It's the best I can do. Unfortunately, I'm not a traveling magician. Now be very careful not to drop it. It is somewhat heavy." Maskell took the lens in his hand and struggled with it for a minute, and then looked at Craig in amazement. The little object weighed at least 20 pounds. Though it was not much bigger than a crown piece. "What stuff can this be, Craig?" Look through it, my good friend. That's what I gave it to you for. Mascal held it with difficulty, directed it toward the gleaming Arcturus, and snatched as long and as steady a glance at the star as the muscles of his arm would permit. And what he saw was this. The star, which to the naked eye appeared as a single yellow point of light, now became clearly split into two bright but minute suns, the larger of which was still yellow, while its smaller companion was a beautiful blue. But this was not all. Apparently, circulating around the yellow sun was a comparatively small and hardly distinguishable satellite, which seemed to shine, not by its own light, but by reflected light. Mascal lowered and raised his arm repeatedly. The same spectacle revealed itself again and again, but he was able to see nothing else. Then he passed back the lens to Crag without a word and stood chewing his underlip. "You take a glimpse, too," scrapped Crag, proffering the glass to Nightspore. Nightspore turned his back and began to pace up and down. Crag laughed sardonically and returned the lens to his pocket. "Well, Mascal, are you satisfied?" "Arcturus, then, is the double sun. And is that third point of light the planet Torments?" "That's our future home, Mascal." Mascal continued to ponder. "You inquire if I am satisfied. I don't know, Crag. It's miraculous, and that's all I could say about it. But I'm satisfied of one thing. There must be very wonderful astronomers at Starkness, and if you invite me to your observatory, I will surely come." "I do invite you. We set off from there." "And you, Nightspore?" demanded Mascal. "The journey has to be made," answered his friend in indistinct tones, "though I don't see what will come of it." Crag shot a penetrating glance at him. "More remarkable adventures than this would need to be arranged before we could excite Nightspore." "Yet he is coming. But not con amore. He is coming merely to bear you company." Mascal again sought the heavy, somber star, gleaming in solitary might in the southeastern heavens. And as he gazed, his heart swelled with grand, painful longings, for which, however, he was unable to account to his own intellect. He felt that his destiny was in some way bound up with this gigantic, far-distant sun, but still he did not dare to admit to himself Crag's seriousness. He heard his parting remarks in deep abstraction, and only after the lapse of several minutes, when alone with Nightspore, did he realize that they referred to such mundane matters as traveling routes and times of trains. "Does Crag travel north with us, Nightspore? I didn't catch that." "No, we go on first, and he joins us at Starkness on the evening of the day after tomorrow." Mascal remained thoughtful. "What am I to think of that man?" "For your information," Nightspore said wearily, "I've never known him to lie." 3. Starkness. A couple of days later, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, Mascal and Nightspore arrived at Starkness Observatory, having covered the 7 miles from Halilar Station on foot. The road, very wild and lonely, ran for the greater part of the way near the edge of rather lofty cliffs, within sight of the North Sea. The sun shone, but a brisk east wind was blowing, and the air was salt and cold. The dark green waves were flecked with white. Throughout the walk, they were accompanied by the plaintive, beautiful crying of the gulls. the observatory presented itself to their eyes as a self-contained little community without neighbors and perched on the extreme end of the land. There were three buildings, a small stone-built dwelling house, a low workshop, and about 200 yards farther north, a square tower of granite masonry, 70 feet in height. The house and the shop were separated by an open yard, littered with waste. A single stone surrounded both, except on the side facing the sea, where the house itself formed a continuation of the cliff. No one appeared. The windows were all closed. Moscow could have sworn that the whole establishment was shut up and deserted. He passed through the open gate, followed by Nightspore, and knocked vigorously at the front door. The knocker was thick with dust and had obviously not been used for a long time. He put his ear to the door, but could hear no movements inside the house. He then tried the handle. The door was locked. They walked around the house, looking for another entrance, but there was only the one door. "This isn't promising," growled Maskell. "There's no one here. Now you try the shed while I go over to that tower." Nightspore, who had not spoken half a dozen words since leaving the train, complied in silence and started off across the yard. Maskell passed out of the gate again. When he arrived at the foot of the tower, which stood some way back from the cliff, he found the door heavily padlocked. Gazing up, he saw six windows, one above the other, at equal distances, all on the east face, that is, overlooking the sea. Realizing that no satisfaction was to be gained there, he came away again, still more irritated than before. When he rejoined his friend, Nightspore reported that the workshop was also locked. "Did we or did we not receive an invitation?" demanded Maskell energetically. "The house is empty," replied Nightspore, biting his nails. "We better break a window. I certainly don't mean to camp out till Crag condescends to come." He picked up an old iron bolt from the yard and, retreating to a safe distance, hurled it against a sash window on the ground floor. The lower pane was completely shattered. Carefully avoiding the broken glass, Maskell thrust his hand through the aperture and pushed back the frame fastening. A minute later, they had climbed through, and they were standing inside the house. The room, which was a kitchen, was in an indescribably filthy and neglected condition. The furniture scarcely held together. Broken utensils and rubbish lay on the floor instead of on the dust heap, and everything was covered with a deep deposit of dust. The atmosphere was so foul that Mascall judged that no fresh air had passed into the room for several months. Insects were crawling on the walls. They were into the other rooms on the lower floor, a scullery, a barely furnished dining room, a storing place for lumber. The same dirt, the mustiness and neglect met their eyes. At least half a year must have elapsed since these rooms were last touched or even entered. "Does your faith in Crag still hold?" asked Mascall. "I confess mine is at a vanishing point. If this affair isn't one big joke, it has every promise of being one. Crag never lived here in his life." "Come upstairs first," said Nightspore. The upstairs rooms proved to consist of a library and three bedrooms. All the windows were tightly closed. The air was insufferable. The beds had been slept in, evidently a long time ago, and had never been made since. The tumbled, discolored bed linen actually preserved the impression of the sleepers. There was no doubt that these impressions were ancient, for all sorts of floating dirt had accumulated on the sheets and coverlets. "Who could have slept here, do you think?" interrogated Mascall. "The observatory staff?" "More like travelers, like ourselves. They left suddenly." Mascall flung the windows wide open in every room he came to and held his breath until he'd done so. Two of the bedrooms faced the sea. The third, the library, was in an upwardly sloping moorland. This library was now the only room left unvisited, and unless they discovered signs of recent occupation here, Mascall made up his mind to regard the whole business as a gigantic hoax. But the library, like the other rooms, was foul with stale air and dust laden. Mascall, having flung the window up and down, fell heavily into an armchair and looked disgustedly at his friend. "Now, what's your opinion of Crag?" Nightspore sat on the edge of the table which stood before the window. "He may still have left a message for us." "A message? Why? Do you mean in this room? I don't see any message." Nightspore's eyes wandered about the room. Finally, seeming to linger upon a glass-fronted wall cupboard, which contained a few old bottles on one of the shelves and nothing else. Mascall glanced at him and at the cupboard, and then without a word he got up to examine the bottles. There were four altogether, one of which was larger than rest. The smaller ones were about 8 inches long. All were torpedo-shaped and had flattened bottoms, which enabled them to stand upright. Two of the smaller ones were empty and unstoppered. The others contained a colorless liquid and possessed queer-looking, nozzle-like stoppers that were connected by a thin metal rod with a catch halfway down the side of the bottle. They were labeled, but the labels were yellow with age and the writing was nearly indecipherable. Mascall carried the filled bottles with him to the table in front of the window in order to get a better light. Nightspore moved away to make room for him. He now made out on the larger bottle the words "solar back rays," and on the other one, after some doubt, he thought that he could distinguish something like "Arcturian back rays." He looked up to stare curiously at his friend. "Have you been here before, Nightspore?" "I guessed Crag would leave a message." "Well, I don't know. It may be a message, but it means nothing to us, or at least all events to me. What are back rays?" "Light that goes back to its source," muttered Nightspore. "And what kind of light would that be?" Knightspor seemed unwilling to answer, but finding Maskell's eyes still fixed on him, he brought out, "Unless light pulled, as well as pushed, how would flowers contrive to twist their heads around after the sun?" "I don't know. The point is, what are these bottles for?" While he was still talking, with his hand on the smaller bottle, the other, which was lying on its side, accidentally rolled over in such a manner that the metal caught against the table. He made a movement to stop it. His hand was actually descending when the bottle suddenly disappeared before his eyes. It had not rolled off the table, but had really vanished. It was nowhere at all. Maskell stared at the table. After a minute, he raised his brows, turned to Knightspor with a smile. "The message grows more intricate." Knightspor looked bored. The valve became unfastened. The contents have escaped through the open window toward the sun, carrying the bottle with them. But the bottle will be burned up by the Earth's atmosphere. The contents will dissipate and will not reach the sun. Maskell listened attentively. His smile faded. "Does anything prevent us from experimenting with this other bottle?" "Replace it in the cupboard," said Knightspor. "Arcturus is still below the horizon, and you would succeed only in wrecking the house." Maskell remained standing before the window, pensively gazing out at the sunlit moors. "Crag treats me like a child," he remarked presently. "Perhaps I really am a child. My cynicism must seem very amusing to Crag. Why does he leave me to find out all this by myself? For I don't include you, Knightspor. What time will Crag be here?" "Not before dark, I expect," his friend replied. 4. The Voice. It was by this time past 3 o'clock. Feeling hungry, for they had eaten nothing since early morning, Maskell went downstairs to forage, but without much hope of finding anything in the shape of food. In a safe in the kitchen, he discovered a bag of moldy oatmeal, which was untouchable, a quantity of quite good tea in an airtight caddy, and an unopened can of ox tongue. Best of all, in the dining room cupboard, he came across an uncorked bottle of first-class Scotch whiskey. He at once made preparations for a scratch meal. A pump in the yard ran clear after a good deal of hard work at it, and he washed out and filled the antique kettle. For firewood, one of the kitchen chairs was broken up with a chopper. The light, dusty wood made a good blaze in the grate. The kettle was boiled, and cups were procured and washed. 10 minutes later, the friends were dining in the library. You're tuned to WORT 89.9 FM, and the show is Fiction Jones. We're reading a novel called A Voyage to Arcturus. This is part 2. We'll continue with the book in a moment.
Hi, this is Casey Fox, host of Guilty Pleasures, every Wednesday night, 8 to 11 p.m. here on WORT. The Milwaukee Film Festival started April 24th and runs for 2 weeks. On my show, April 30th, I'll be featuring oodles of interviews with producers and directors of films coming up at the Oriental and Downer Theaters in the Lower East Side of Milwaukee. It'd be great to have you tuned in to find a movie right in your wheelhouse that you can maybe take your friends and or relatives to make a day of it in Milwaukee. So please tune in Wednesday, April 30th, 8 to 11 p.m. as I highlight week 2 of the Milwaukee Film Festival.
Nights four ate and drank little, but Mascal sat down with a good appetite. There being no milk, whiskey took the place of it. The nearly black tea was mixed with an equal quantity of the spirit. Of this concoction, Mascal drank cup after cup, and long after the tongue had disappeared, he was still imbibing. Nightspore looked at him queerly. "Do you intend to finish the whole bottle before Greg comes?" "Greg won't want any of this. One must do something. I feel restless. Let's take a look at the country." The cup, which was on its way to Mascal's lips, remained poised in the air. "Do you have anything in view, Nightspore?" "Well, let's walk out on the gap of Sorgi." "What is that?" "It's a show place," answered Nightspore, biting his lip. Mascal finished off the cup and rose to his feet. "Walking is better than soaking at any time, and especially on a day like this. How far is it?" 3 or 4 miles each way." "You probably mean something," said Mascal, "for I'm beginning to regard you as a second Crag. But if so, so much the better. I'm growing nervous. I need incidents." They left the house by the door, which they left ajar, and immediately found themselves again on the moorland road that had brought them from Alalar. This time, they continued along it, past the tower. Mascal, as they went by, regarded the erection with puzzled interest. "What is that tower, Nightspore?" "We sail for the platform on the top." "Tonight?" throwing him a quick look. "Yeah." Mascal smiled, but his eyes were grave. "Then we're looking at the gateway of Arcturus, and Crag is now traveling north to unlock it." "You no longer think it's impossible, then," mumbled Nightspore. After a minute or two, the road parted from the seacoast and swerved sharply inland across the hills. With Nightspore as guide, they left it. They took to the grass. A faint sheep path marked the way along the cliff edge for some distance, but at the end of another mile, it vanished. The two men then had some rough walking up and down hillsides across deep gullies. The sun disappeared behind the hills, and twilight imperceptibly came on. They soon reached a spot where further progress appeared impossible. The buttress of a mountain descended at a steep angle to the very edge of the cliff, forming an impassable slope of slippery grass. Mascal halted, stroked his beard, and wondered what the next step was to be. "There's a little scrambling here," said Nightspore. "We're both used to climbing. There's not much in it." He indicated a narrow ledge winding along the face of the precipice, a few yards beneath where they were standing. It averaged from 15 to 30 inches in width. Without waiting for Maskell's consent in the undertaking, he instantly swung himself down and started walking along this ledge at a rapid pace. Maskell, seeing that there was no help for it, followed. The shelf did not extend for above a quarter of a mile, but its passage was somewhat unnerving. There was a sheer drop to the sea, 400 feet below. In a few places, they had to sidle along without placing one foot before another. The sound of the breakers came up to them in a low, threatening roar. Upon rounding a corner, the ledge broadened out into a fair-sized platform of rock and came to a sudden end. A narrow inlet of the sea separated them from the continuation of the cliffs beyond. "As we can't get any further," said Maskell, "I presume this is your gap of Sorgi?" "Yes," answered his friend, first dropping on his knees and then lying at full length, face downward. He drew his head and shoulders over the edge and began to stare straight down at the water. "What is there so interesting?" Knight Spore. Receiving no reply, however, he followed his friend's example and the next minute was looking for himself. Nothing was to be seen. The gloom had deepened. The sea was nearly invisible. But while he was ineffectually gazing, he heard what sounded like the beating of a drum on the narrow strip of shore below. It was very faint, but quite distinct. The beats were in 4/4 time, with the third beat slightly accented. He now continued to hear the noise all the time he was lying there. The beats were in no way drowned by the far louder sound of the surf, but seemed somehow to belong to a different world. When they were on their feet again, he questioned Knight Spore. "We came here solely to hear that?" Knight Spore cast one of his odd looks at him. "It's called locally the Drum Taps of Sorgi. You will not hear that name again. Perhaps you will hear the sound again." If I do hear it, what will that imply? It bears its own message. Only try always to hear it more and more distinctly when you do. Now it's growing dark. We have to get back. Mascal pulled out his watch automatically and looked at the time. It was past 6. But he was thinking of Night Spore's words, not of the time. Night had already fallen by the time they regained the tower. The black sky was glorious with liquid stars. Arcturus was a little way above the sea, directly opposite them in the east. As they were passing the base of the tower, Mascal observed with a sudden shock that the gate was open. He caught hold of Nightspore's arm violently. "Look, Craig's back." "Yes. We have to make haste to the house." "Why not the tower? He's probably in there. Since the gate's open, I'm going up to look." Nightspore grunted, but made no opposition. All was pitch black inside the gate. Mascal struck a match, and the flickering light disclosed the lower end of a circular flight of stone steps. "Well, are you coming up?" he asked. "No, I'll wait here." Mascal immediately began the ascent. Hardly had he mounted half a dozen steps, however, before he was compelled to pause to gain breath. He seemed to be carrying upstairs not one Mascal, but 3. As he proceeded, the sensation of crushing weight, so far from diminishing, grew worse and worse. It was nearly physically impossible to go on. His lungs could not take in enough oxygen. His heart thumped like a ship's engine. Sweat coursed down his face. At the 20th step, he completed the first revolution of the tower and came face to face with the first window, which was set in a high embrasure. Realizing that he could not go higher, he struck another match and climbed into the embrasure in order that he might, at all events, see something from the tower. The flame died, and he stared through the window at the stars. Then, to his astonishment, he discovered that it was not a window at all, but a lens. The sky was not a wide expanse of space containing a multitude of stars, but a blurred darkness, focusing only in one part, where 2 very bright stars, like small moons in size, appeared in close conjunction. And near them, a more minute planetary object, as brilliant as Venus, with an observable disk. One of the suns shone with a glaring white light, the other was a weird, awful blue. Their light, though almost solar in intensity, did not illuminate the interior of the tower at all. Mascal knew at once that the system of spheres at which he was gazing was what is known to astronomy as the star Arcturus. He had seen the sight before through Crag's glass, but then the scale had been smaller. The colors of the twin suns had not appeared in their naked reality. These colors seemed to him most marvelous, as if in seeing them through Earth eyes, he was not seeing them correctly. But it was at torments that he stared the longest and the most earnestly. On that mysterious and terrible Earth, countless millions of miles distant, he had been promised him that he would set foot, even though he might leave his bones there. The strange creatures that he was to behold and touch were already living at this very moment. A low, sighing whisper sounded in his ear from not more than a yard away. "Don't you understand, Maskal, that you are only an instrument to be used and then broken? Nightspore is asleep now, but when he wakes, you must die. You will go, and he will return." Maskal hastily struck another match with trembling fingers. No one was in sight, and all was quiet as a tomb. The voice did not sound again. After waiting a few minutes, he redescended to the foot of the tower. On gaining the open air, his sensation of weight was instantly removed, but he continued panting, palpitating, like a man who had lifted a far too heavy load. Nightspore's dark form came forward. Was Crag there? If he was, I didn't see him, but I heard someone speak. Was it Crag? It was not Crag, but a voice warned me against you. Yeah, you'll hear those voices too, said Nightspore enigmatically. That was part two of A Voyage to Arcturus. I'll be back on the third Friday of the next month with part three. So have a great month. You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM, right here in Madison, Wisconsin.
Attention WORT volunteers and donors. WORT is holding an election for 4 open board seats, 2 participating member seats, and 1 listener sponsor seat to serve 3-year terms, and 1 listener sponsor seat to serve a 2-year term, all 4 terms beginning at the annual meeting in June. The 2-year seat will conclude in June 2027, while the 3-year seats will conclude June 2028. Financial acumen, computer literacy, and a willingness to work with a dynamic group to help shape this great station are all desirable qualifications. People of underrepresented groups are strongly encouraged to apply. Some committee hours are required outside of board meetings. Applications must be received by 5 p.m. on Thursday, May 15th, to ensure consideration. Voting begins on Thursday, May 29th, and continues until the annual meeting on Sunday, June 29th. More information and board applications are available at wortfm.org or on paper in the station lobby. Help us keep WORT a vibrant and important part of our community. Apply today.
Make Music Madison is back on June 21st for the 13th annual day of free outdoor live music across